3.
Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, original members of Yes reconvene for the anniversary of their breakthrough third album.
I've seen all good people turn their heads each day, so satisfied I'm on my way.
And I think that was a good thing about the Yes group, that it would never take no for an answer.
I've seen all good people turn their heads each day, so satisfied I'm on my way.
Isn't that a good line?
I must say, a lot of it was down to the energy of Bill Bruford, because initially any band is only as active and creative and as good as its drummer. That's where it all starts.
The first two albums were obviously not successful, even in England. It was fortunately it was a time where you could go through three albums, and the record company kind of let you go on.
Hi, this is John Anderson, and you are in the studio for the Yes album.
The 50th anniversary interviews with the members of Yes are next. Of all the bands that came to the forefront in the progressive rock movement of the early 1970s, none found more critical and commercial success than Yes. A number of bands, including King Crimson and Genesis, like Yes, based in London, were incorporating jazz and classical influences into rock, creating complex pieces of music while experimenting with new, often electronic sounds then. What distinguished Yes from other progressive rock bands back then was that the grandeur of the music never obscured the melody of the song. John Anderson's unmistakably high, clear singing voice and bassist Chris Squire's harmonies gave Yes a focal point and a lyrical framework strong enough to support the band's dazzling musicianship. John Anderson remembers that he and Chris Squire lucked out, getting a world-class, technically proficient drummer from a tiny newspaper ad.
Bill Bruford, he was advertising in The Melody Maker, and it's a very sort of typical story. I rang him up, me and Chris rang him and said, you play drums? And he said, yeah, I'm a good drummer. So the only way we knew which was a good drummer was if he had a Ludwig kit, if he had a drum kit called Ludwig. So we said, do you play Ludwig? And he said, yeah, of course I do. And I think what he did, he quickly sprayed his sonar kit black to look like a Ludwig, you see. So when he came to do a sort of a audition, if you like, it looked like a Ludwig kit. But he was a good player, you see. So that worked pretty well. And he had a car, which helped. I mean, it was only a Mini. It was a very small car. He said it was his, actually. It was a girlfriend of his. But then he was in the group, right? He was in the group before we met him. And then we got Tony Kay, very groovy guy. I'd met Tony 4 years before in Leicester, or was it Manchester? So we sort of knew each other, and Pete Banks was there. And he was already with Chris in a group called Mabel Greer's Toy Shop. So the first thing I said to Chris was, maybe we should change the name. I'm very energetic and very fast and very furious and smaller than Chris. He's sort of, he's taller, slower, more concise. Decisions out of Chris take a long time, but when they come, he sticks through them, you know, which is a great thing for Chris. I think that a lot of the musical things over the years would have gone too light. But for Chris sort of brings it back down to earth because of his Pisces, and he has that sort of earth, water energy, you know. It does take a long time to get things coordinated in his mind, but I think that's a very good sort of situation, because I tend to just fly away like crazy. I come up with ideas like very fast. But it's always been in a way, a little battle between me and Chris as to how it all finishes up, how it all turns out. Me with a zillion ideas and him with a more decisive point of view.
The only musician to appear on every Yes album over the many years, Yes co-founder, bass player, and harmony singer Chris Squire in the studio.
I must say, a lot of it was down to the energy of Bill Bruford, because initially, any band is only as active and creative and as good as its drummer. That's where it all starts. And he kind of like was a very much a driving force in that period. That influence on Yes was a very good one. He was a particularly good influence on me.
Original Yes drummer, Bill Bruford.
Usually, he presented them with a great deal of vigor, a great deal of muscle, and a great deal of, if you don't like it, think of something better. That's usually was John's approach. So he would play something really horrendously terrible. And most people would say, oh, do we have to play this? Oh, no. Well, all right, if we've got to, why don't you put the sixth there in the chord and play it like that? And then somebody would say, yeah, but if you put an F in the bass instead of the G root, then it'll sound better. And you see what happens. The original idea would become turned into music by the four competent musicians around him. So he would bang out some horrendous, god-awful noise over one chord, getting his fingers caught in the strings, with a look in his eyes which said, if you don't like this, quit or make it better. Which is a technique, you know, that Hitler would use. Somewhere slightly to the right of Hitler. And of course, people would say, oh, you know, do I have to leave the group? No. All right, well, let's tell him that if you move the G6 to the G-6, then it'll sound really good, you know. And so that's what would happen. And then somebody would say, well, that sounds quite good. And hey, presto, the ball is up and running. Often used by band leaders in some way or another. It's throwing down a gauntlet saying, I'm doing this. If you guys can like it, or you can leave it, or you can improve it. So we'd improve it.
We'll be right back.
I remember when we rehearsed that song, Yours Is No Disgrace, it was a group activity and it became an instrumental piece of music, far and above just a song. It was maybe two-thirds instrumental and the other third was the song. And it really has survived the years very, very well. These musical emblems within just one song. And once we'd done that, we knew that any song that came around at that time, we would do the same thing. We would sort of make it into two or three parts as a matter of course. I was listening then very much to the pop classics, Stravinsky, New World Symphonies. A lot of structure was sort of coming through into the Yes music because I'd learned it through listening to the classics. So I'd understand why it calmed down. Why did it go quiet there? Why it developed and all of a sudden, bam, it was back in again. Then it quietened down. The 1812 Overture gets to a peak three times and then quietens down. And, you know, it sort of breathes, if you like.
Here's the original Yes keyboard player, Tony Kaye.
For instance, at the beginning, we did covers of other people's songs, like the Beatles thing and the Crosby, Stills and Nash thing and a couple of other, America, and that kind of stuff. And we just put it into a different musical ballpark, really, and embellished it and made it more symphonic and more instrumental. And the first two albums didn't really reflect, you know, what was coming. It was like the start of the way that we were thinking, and up until the Yes album, it was just kind of trying to do, you know, something different, really, and playing to English audiences who, in a way, for most part, was pretty much of an uphill battle. It was really start of another era where bands, you know, like the Nice and early Genesis were really trying to do something different. I guess we were trying to catch on to something that we really didn't know what it was going to be, but we wanted to push it in another direction. And the first two albums were obviously not successful, even in England. It was fortunately it was a time where you could go through three albums, and the record company kind of let you go on.
I was very lucky because when I first started working with Chris and Tony and Peter and Bill, there was definitely a feeling that we were all experimenting. It was a very, very great time in London for experimenting around 68, 69. The five major bands that came out of that time were King Crimson, ELP, Yes, Zeppelin, Deep Purple. These were groups of people that, unbeknown to themselves, were doing very, very similar activity. It was like nobody really knew what each other groups were doing. It just happens that around that period of time, everybody was sort of setting the sort of stall, the sort of theatre for the early 70s kind of music, which in a way came over from England to America. In 68, we were sort of the local band in London that was spoken about very well. And then we went to the speakeasy one night and we heard this band was playing called King Crimson. And we said, okay, well, let's check them out, see how good they are. And they were great. They seriously were great. And we all sort of, big gloom, you know, we had a big cloud over us for about a week, trying to get over the fact that they were better than us, you know, or more ingenuitive. You know, I mean, they were more, very similar attitude to music, but more organized. And that pushed the group on, you know, it made them work harder. And when we saw Mahavishnu, it made the band work harder. And I think that was a good thing about the Yes group, that it would never take no for an answer. Isn't that a good line?
Thank you.
Coming up next, to join John Anderson, Chris Squire, Bill Bruford, and Tony Kaye will be the second guitarist, Steve Howe, who made his first band appearance on the Yes album. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the 50th anniversary of the Yes album.
Hello, this is John Anderson of Yes.
Hi, this is Tony Kaye, and you're in the studio for the Yes album.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Steve Howe of Yes with Redbeard.
Thanks again, guys. Yes lead singer John Anderson comments on their first addition to the original lineup after the departure of guitarist Banks.
When Steve Howe joined the group, it made us more musical. Our scope was more musical. Peter Banks, very good guitar player, but his scope was sort of limited at times, where when Steve came in, we had all this sort of Baroque attitude to music and some very classical trained attitude to music, country and western. Steve could really jump from one thing to another very fast, very talented man. I actually saw him a month before we actually got together, and I went to the speakeasy and he was playing, and I remember walking right past him underneath the stage and just looking at this guy with this beautiful guitar playing so many notes and so clear, singing away with his guitar. And I remembered that I thought he was very, very, you know, very clear in his style. And then his name came up a month later, and I said, well, if he'll join, let's go for it. And he did join. It was definitely a good move for him. It was a good move for the group. He enjoyed himself immensely. And obviously, when you're happy, your music gets better. And he got better and better within that first couple of months of rehearsal. Me and Steve became very close. We had very similar attitudes to making music. So we'd sit down and write songs without any effort. And music actually is effortless, the more clear the combination of people. It isn't hard to make music. That's the fact. And we really enjoyed recording the Yes album. It didn't take too long. What we really wanted to do was to get on the road and show this new guy off, you know?
Replacing original Yes guitarist Peter Banks for the recording of the band's third album was Steve Howe, who reminded us how workmanlike and uncomplicated recording was then, relatively speaking.
Yeah, I mean, 1970, we all lived in England. Yeah. You know, the sound of the group was consistently British. Because we used to make records, we used to go in and we'd have a month and then we'd do a few shows and then we'd have another month. I mean, we used to make records either in a four-month block, like Topographic took 4 months. That was considered at the time.
There was four sides of music.
Yeah.
4 months?
And that was incredibly short by today's standards.
Yeah, crazy to do that amount of time in a studio.
But then Paul Simon recorded Bridge Over Troubled Waters, the album, and that took a year, and that kind of set a whole new precedent. I mean, it meant that every musician now could take a year to do his album, because that's how you did an album that good.
Yes, original keyboard player Tony Kaye.
I was probably one of the first people in the band to have heard Steve. Yes, he was playing in a band that used to play at a club that I used to frequent very often. I think it was called Bodast, and it was mainly it wasn't that progressive. It was mainly a rock and roll band. I saw Steve play, and I thought, this guy's really got something else. But he was playing in a band that was really quite a raunchy rock and roll band, which is something that I kind of wanted for the band at that time. As soon as he came into the band, he went into a different mode and started playing much more progressive guitar than this kind of raunchy player that I remembered. So it was kind of strange. Although for the Yes album, it was fine. But on from that, probably for me, it was too, the conflict between keyboards and guitar was too much of a conflict, really. Although that was the direction that Yes was going, a lot of notes. And although the Yes album turned really to be quite a simple album in many respects, considering where Yes went on to from there.
Again, Yes co-founder, lyricist and singer John Anderson.
The idea of strong melody came from one classical composer called Stravinsky. Stravinsky made music which was being made by lots of people, very similar kind of music, very avant-garde, but he retained something that they didn't, and that was the melodies. And if you listen to any Stravinsky, he holds it all together with melody. And I never wanted to lose that. So I was more of the melodious type, where the guys in the band would be often running on ideas, figurative licks. Out of that, I realized that if it all went that way, we'd have a Mahavishnu of sorts. And yes, wasn't as good as that kind of sorts. It was what it was within itself, and it needed a voice, or voices. I think that's what we always tried to make sure we wanted, was a lot of harmony. Me, Steve, and Chris singing together had a certain texture, and we worked on that all the way through that period of time. During the course of songs like I've Seen All Good People, it was a definite idea to have a developing quiet song and then just break open into a full church organ sort of thing, and grandioso, very, very big, massive, in fact. Let's get the cathedral choir in there and that kind of thing. And, you know, it was a very sort of strong feeling about making it very grand, and then it can go into nothing. And out of that nothing comes a drum roll, and then into this funky down, da 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 da, which is on record is very light, very, very. I think it's played by acoustic guitar, most of it. And then the guitar solo comes in electric. By then, you see, we were very getting into the actual production side of things. You know, we'd left it to other people before. I've seen all good people turn their heads each day, so satisfied I'm on my way. I've seen all good people turn their heads each day, so satisfied I'm on my way. Take a straight and stronger course to the corner of your life. Make the White Queen run so fast, she hasn't got time to make you a wife. 'Cause it's time in time with your time, and this news is captured. I remember when we were doing I've Seen All Good People, your move was like a syncopated. The thing was that I remember someone coming in, a famous producer, saying, why don't you put a bass line in or something like that? I said, no, it's got to have nothing there. It's just got to go like that, like a heartbeat, you know? So we were very, very adamant about what we were trying to do as a group. We were trying to do something a little bit different. There was that combination of this is the way we're going, so you better hang in with it, because we don't know where we're going. We just want to change things a little bit, you know? And the audiences were doing it as well. Audiences were willing to sit and listen to Long Distance Run Around, Yours Is No Disgrace, Heart of the Sunrise, music that really lasted longer than the norm. I think they were definitely more able to release their joy of what they heard. I mean, they wouldn't sit there and wait until the end of the song and then clap and cheer. They'd do it halfway through, and really that was so new to us. And I think that the audiences that came to see us in that first 2 or 3 years inspired us to do Close to the Edge and Topographic, and made us want to do these very longer, how can I explain it, different way of looking at music. We just hoped that the audiences would like it. You know, that was the thing to go for. You just say, well, this will really make them sit up and listen or something. And for the first few times we played these pieces of music, it was sort of a blank out there, just saying, I wonder if they like them, because the album had just come out and we were out there touring. But within about a month, they all started to somehow just sing along with them. And all of a sudden we realized that, well, if they're willing to go this way, this is great, because this is where we want to go. And I think this is really what it's all about, that you try out ideas on yourself first and foremost. And if you really appreciate them, then you release it to the audiences. And you hope that somebody out there likes what you're trying to do. And if they do, then you follow through and do some more of it.
Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio with John Anderson, Bill Bruford, Tony Kaye, Steve Howe, and the late Yes co-founder Chris Squire. I'm Redbeard. That's next in the studio as we continue on the 50th anniversary of the Yes album. Yes co-founder, lyricist, and lead singer John Anderson looks back across the 5 decades since the making of the Yes album in the studio.
If I look back in those days, there was a certain element of, well, if you go to America and you do well, in a way, you're sort of selling out and you have your hit records and things like that, and nobody will love you in England ever again. And strangely, we held on to the musical side of the group as our sort of armor against that sort of possibility where the business would try to manipulate you and tell you, okay, well, you've had your hit records, you've got to make more hit records. No, we sort of said, no, we're going to carry on making albums. We are making an album's worth of music that we can perform on stage. And we really kept to that sort of attitude. It didn't rub very well with everybody, especially in the business side. Or some critics at times started to say, well, who do you think you are, you know, doing long pieces of music and stuff like that. But me and Chris initially decided that we wouldn't be too much of a here today, gone tomorrow band. We wanted to do something a little bit more creative. And we were very lucky. We seemed to keep bumping into the right musicians at the right time to join the group and to make it solid, you know.
Yes guitarist Steve Howe, who debuted with the band with their 3rd album, marvels at modern methods of recording utilizing the completion backwards principle, which in comparison makes the Yes album recording seem like primary colors.
But it's different listening to a 19 record made in 1990 than 1970.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not too bothered that things might go out of time or the edits aren't really right, you know. But the feel, you know, we were actually recording a performance then, but now we've reinvented, not just us in particular, but the recording industry has reinvented part of performances, and it's a new listening experience. It's got it's really diversified from the emotional experience to the, I think, perfectionistic, but very, it's almost like a cleansing process. The music, by being so right, can do something beyond what just an emotional record that has an earlier rock record that has inadequacies and it drags, or, you know, the snare drums keeps being late.
Right.
We lived with all that because we didn't know how to fix it, but now we do know how to fix it, and it's different musical experience. It's gone a long way from just the emotion, which is almost unspeakable. You can't really talk about that. It sounds very pretentious, really.
Those great hits that we all look fondly back on that came off of 45 RPM records and stuff like that, they weren't done this way, and I wouldn't change them.
Oh, no.
I wouldn't change a thing about
them. I wish we could make records like that again.
Well,
yes, because absolutely. People genuinely want to. And some producers, like Trevor Horn, who's a good friend of mine, has gone every which way around to try and get something like that again. But that's the time. That is the date. You know, a 1965 record, you know, I mean, you can fake it, you know, and I hear a few people that do try that. But basically, you can't avoid the techniques and the availability of, as you were saying, technology.
Here are first John Anderson and then Chris Squire in the studio.
I think we were always into sort of uplifting music. You know, I personally didn't follow the Stones into their satanic realm. I followed the Beatles into All You Need Is Love. That was my dream. I loved it. And I tended to follow that train of thought. It's something we're sort of driven to write this kind of music, and it's not even soul searching. It's very spirited music in many ways, and very the love of life, the love and need for understanding, ecology. And in some ways, all you have to do is to put that into musical form, and you become part and parcel of the people. You're with the people. They want to hear their train of thought put into musical form. That's why they come and see a concert. And we need them to affirm that we're doing the right thing. And the word yes is that affirmation.
I think definitely the yes theme has always been a hopeful one. I think, rather than light and dark, I think we've used dark expressionism in order to show the difference between good and evil, or light and dark, which, you know, whichever way it is. But usually, even if the songs refer to darkness, it's because there's a positive attitude at the end of it, you know.
Every single day, inside. as one of many ones of me. As truth is gathered, I rearrange inside.
Save me. Sadly, the perpetual change of life includes the passing of Chris Squire in 2015. But gladly, Yes was finally inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 2 years later. I'm Redbeard in the studio thanking my guests, John Anderson, Tony Kaye, Bill Bruford, and Steve Howe. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2021, all rights reserved. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net.